The Adolescent and His Culture, Part 2. We will look at some of the hot topics such as music and sex, but I'd like to quote to you a book from the late 80s, by Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. In the foreword, Mr. Postman writes, "We were keeping our eye on 1984. When the year came and the prophecy didn't, thoughtful Americans sang softly in praise of themselves. The roots of liberal democracy had held. Wherever else the terror had happened, we, at least, had not been visited by Orwellian nightmares." But he goes on to say what Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared in A Brave New World was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one left who wanted to read one. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny fail to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. Postman's book is an excellent study in this MTV generation and how we have used television, among other things, to amuse ourselves and to distract us from the really important issues of life. I think that we'll find, as we continue to counsel adolescents, that there's a growing hunger on their part for meaning, but there is also a growing lack of understanding in how to find meaning. We've taught them through television and quick fixes and pat answers that meaning should come easily and quickly, and we've taught them short attention spans. And so don't be surprised when, during your counseling, it's hard to counsel them for very long unless you're really engaging them in the conversation and doing a lot of listening and a lot of question asking, because you'll lose them. You'll lose them perhaps more quickly than you might imagine because of this short attention span and because they're used to being entertained when they learn something. James Davison Hunter, in his book Culture Wars, has warned us of the shallowness of our generation. He says, the contemporary culture war is not just an expression of different opinions or attitudes on this or that issue, like abortion. If this were all there was to it, the conflict I refer to would be, as someone once suggested, the politics of distraction, a trivial pursuit that keeps Americans from settling more important matters. No, the conflict is deeper than mere differences of opinion, and bigger than abortion. As suggested earlier, the culture wars emerges over fundamentally different conceptions of moral authority, over different ideas and beliefs about truth, the good, obligation to one another, the nature of community, and so on. It is, therefore, cultural conflict at its deepest level. Now, the reason that I mention Hunter and Postman is to once again give us the idea that what's happening is of a very shallow nature, and neither the adolescents nor their parents are used to thinking very deeply about it. So when we look at music, for instance, parents often are aghast at lyrics if they ever actually listen to the lyrics. Adolescents often will say they don't listen to the lyrics, and yet if you gave them another song of the same type, syncopation, with clean lyrics, often they find something wrong with it. Maybe they don't even know why. But the issues are much deeper than simply the music. It has to do with what's behind the music, what the music is saying, and why adolescents want to hear it. if you think back to the 60s and some of the music that stirred up emotion back then, some of the Bob Dylan type music and lyrics, it wasn't the music itself that did the deed. It was the restlessness in the youth, the rebellion in the youth against their parents, against the establishment, eventually even against their own professors that were telling them they ought to rebel. It was their rebellious spirit that mixed with the music and led to rioting or things of less violent nature, nevertheless rebellion. And we have to remember, as we're looking at the issue of music, which I'd like to do now, that the music in and of itself doesn't stir up the trouble. It has to mix with a heart that is rebellious. And parents are often worried about the lyrics, about the groups, but we have to continue to remind parents that the strongest influence they have on their children is the fact that they live consistent, holy lives, and that the parents themselves are not open to the charge of hypocrisy, that they are living what they want their children to live. Now, when we face the issue of music, I know in the last decade, as Christians would talk about music, it would take on various forms. Often they would get into backmasking and the satanic symbols and the satanic overtones and the sexual overtones. And certainly those satanic and sexual overtones are there and sometimes very blatant. I remember one group even advertised on the front of their album, warning, this album contains backmasking. Now, the reason they did that, of course, was to sell albums, and they wanted to come across as the bad boys. And sometimes these things backfire on us. What I have found most helpful in dealing with music is to deal with it like you would a book or something else that you're going to critique. Listen to the lyrics. Look at the jacket of the CD. See how the people dress. If you have interviews, read the interviews. See how the people talk. Talk these things over with your children. If they want to listen to a certain kind of music you're unaware of, listen to it together. But don't tell the parents, and you as a counselor, don't just sit there and criticize the music. And certainly don't talk about how much better your music was or is. What we want to do is we want to be reflective, and we want to show that we can critique with a fairly open mind their music. We can talk about the lyrics, and the teenager himself or herself may tell us, well, yeah, that's saying a lot of terrible stuff, but I don't listen to the words, I just listen to the music. And that opens up a good discussion for what do we really hear, what sticks with us. Can this become a part of your thinking without really meaning for it to? But remember, as soon as we criticize them and say they shouldn't listen to it, they're going to point out some things that their parents watch or listen to and say, well, doesn't that stick with you? And there's some tough questions that we have to answer, because sometimes we're not listening to anything that's any better. We listen to country music or something else that's just as bad, perhaps even worse. And so, again, we need to be consistent and we need to be willing to critique. So I suggest that the music is reflective of their identity. The music is not the cause of their identity. If the teenager is being rebellious, he's not rebellious simply because of the music. He's listening to that kind of music because of what's going on in his heart. And I encourage the counselor and the parent not to overreact, to be very humble, to talk to them about it, but don't overreact. I would also suggest that you ask questions about the music without attacking the music. For many, to attack their music is the same as attacking their character or their friends. I've found that even in adults, that if you criticize their music, whatever it might be, people take that very personally. And I think there's a reason for it. Because music does reflect something inside of us that we identify with. I also encourage you not to chase down conspiracy theories. Don't get too tied up in all the ideas of what group is worshiping Satan and whether you see the face of Satan in this thing or that thing. And there have always been those things. There always will be those things because they sell records. And you might just point that out if those kinds of things come up. I think what's more important is to talk about the image that this group is trying to project, pointing out to the adolescent that they are trying to project an image. There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody in entertainment does that. But what is the image, and is it a good image? Is it something that they should emulate? Also, again, talking about the words and the meaning. Finally, we want to teach them to think critically about these groups and to be realistic about these groups. They may come back at us and say, well, what about this or that group back when you were a kid? You know, how stupid they were. And then we need to agree with them. We need to show them that we can think critically about our stuff, just like we're trying to help them think critically about theirs. Not every rock group is as bad as every other rock group. Perhaps in your opinion, some of them are just fine. But we need to be able to communicate why they're just fine or why they're not so fine, and do so in a logical, rational fashion, not in an attacking fashion. I've been through much of that with my, not only the people in my youth group, but with my own children, my oldest daughter, and I made some real mistakes, I think, in banning some things from the house rather than listening with her and helping her think critically about it. I've learned over the years that it's much better just to say, okay, if you're going to listen to that music, we're all going to listen to it. And then when we all listen to it, somehow it takes the edge off for the teenager, and they sometimes begin to then get embarrassed about what they're actually listening to. And that opens up for a whole new discussion. So when it comes to music, we have to be very careful. People take it very, very personally. And it's not worth damaging our relationship with them simply to make the point that we don't like this or that group, or that this or that group is unhealthy or unwholesome for them. We want to lead them in a discussion that we hope they'll end up agreeing with us. But even if they don't agree with us, we want to preserve the relationship so we can talk with them further about other issues. I really find that important. And it's the same thing with television shows or radio talk show hosts. I said earlier, one man taught me a big lesson because I said something about his radio talk show host that, number one, he didn't like, and number two, wasn't true. He set me straight, and I found that he was right, and I apologized and let him know that that he taught me a big lesson. And so we went on to have a good discussion about that person. I still don't care for that talk show host, but I have a new understanding of that person. Okay, that's not fair. You're probably sitting there thinking, now, who is he talking about? It's Howard Stern. That's who I'm thinking of. That's who I'm talking about that I don't really care for. But I do have a more complete understanding of Howard Stern now that I've talked with this other young man. We need to now turn to the issue of sex. Obviously, we won't be exhaustive here on the issue, but it is important for us to look at it, even if a bit briefly, because it is so important. Let me make a couple of points that you'll no doubt want to think on. When it comes to sex, I would suggest that as you're talking with a new person, a new teenage client, that you ask them what they think about it. What do they think in terms of its morality? Should they be involved in it? Should they not? Again, don't overreact, just like the music. Don't, if they tell you that, whatever they tell you, try not to overreact, but seek to understand what they're saying. Be sure you have it straight. I would encourage you not to drop a lot of statistics and scare tactics on them about all the different diseases they can get. Rather, just ask them if they're aware of the problems, if they are aware of disease complications. If they say yes, you might ask them what precautions they've taken if they are sexually active. Just see where their thinking is on it, but see also if their behavior matches what they're saying. Some people may want to talk a good game. They may want to see how you're going to react, and they may sound or talk like they're sexually active and may not really be. On the other hand, they may be afraid you're going to tell their parents. So it's important to ask them some of these questions, even if they say they are not sexually active. One of the things that they often will buy into is, and I hear this mostly from young men, is the what I call the "I gotta have it" line. That it's that sex is something is. In fact, I had a teenage woman tell me this once, that it was just like eating. It's something you gotta have. And I said, "You really mean that? You really mean that if you don't have it, you're going to die?" Well, she hedged a little, but she tried to say that it was an emotional necessity to have sex, and if you didn't have it, then there'd be something wrong with you. Well, in as nice a way as possible, I hope you can tell such a young person that no, they're wrong. It's not a biological or emotional necessity. It's, in fact, the longer you abstain, the easier it is to abstain. You can talk a little bit about libido cycles and how some times of the month or even year, the temptation may be stronger, but that you don't have to have it, as they say. In fact, you can be quite healthy and never engage in sex, as some have gone a lifetime without engaging in sex. But they're probably going to ask you, why should I wait? All my friends are doing it. Now, that is probably not true, but they will talk like it's true, and they may even think it's true, but it's probably not. But if all my friends are doing it, if it's readily available, if I'm afraid that if I don't have sex, it may mean that I'm homosexual or that I'm not really a man or not fully a woman. They have all the lines. And so they really want you to prove it to them why they should wait. And let me encourage you, too, that whatever exterior, whatever face they're putting on about this, sometimes they really do want a good reason not to, because it is often very uncomfortable. Not only just because of the guilt, sometimes it's very uncomfortable physically, but sometimes it's just uncomfortable because they are just not ready for that kind of intimacy with someone. Certainly not someone simply in the back of a car somewhere. So let's look at a few verses that give us good reason why to wait for sex until marriage. We find it in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, verse 14, "You shall not commit adultery." In Matthew 5:27 through 30, we find the passage where Jesus has said, "I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart," and goes on then to talk about if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. The idea in those last verses being that if something causes you a particular problem, then you should cut that thing out of your life, metaphorically. Galatians 5:19 tell us that the acts of the sinful nature are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity, and debauchery. In the NIV, often you'll find the word fornication is spoken of as immorality. In Romans 1:18, a verse we've mentioned before, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And then skipping down to verse 24, therefore God gave them over in their sinful desires to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. The idea that sexual immorality and sexual impurity is a perversion of God's gift of sex. In Galatians 6:7-9, we read, "Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. The one who sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest, if we do not give up." In 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 3, "It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality." In Jude 1:7, "In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire." One thing that the adolescent needs to know is not only what immorality leads to right now, but what it can lead to in the future. You know, there used to be the talk, and I suppose still is, about marijuana opening people up to other drugs. Well, immorality, sexual immorality, certainly opens up people to a world of sin that they did not know before, because it touches so much of who they are, and it affects so much. So many people reject the faith for sexual immorality, and we need to be prepared to talk with them very seriously about that. There's another aspect of all this, though, that inevitably comes up, and that is the subject of masturbation. It's a subject that few talk about, partly because it can be an embarrassing subject to talk about, partly because there's not one verse in Scripture that we can point to that we're certain is talking about masturbation. However, I think that Dr. John White has written an excellent chapter on the subject in his book, Eros Defiled. That's Eros Defiled, The Christian and Sexual Sin, published by InterVarsity Press. The reference will be in your literature for this course. And in his chapter entitled Sex on a Desert Island, he speaks very frankly about masturbation, what it is, what it isn't, the problem with it, why he considers it sin. And I encourage anyone who is either struggling with the issue themselves or working with other people in the area of sexual addictions to read this chapter. But I also point you to a later work of his called Eros Redeemed, in which he talks further about that subject, as well as all sexual sin. Dr. White is one who has taken the subject on head-on and is very clear about it and very clear about explaining it as sin. If you were to look back at the Matthew passage, Matthew 5:27-30, about the idea of lust in your heart, no one who masturbates ever does so without imagining themselves in a sexual encounter with the opposite sex, and that certainly must constitute lust of the heart. So, in dealing with this, learn to be very sensitive about it, to talk about it without shame, but we have to present clearly what Scripture says about it. Now, some very popular people today have said that masturbation is not wrong and that we simply heap guilt on young people because they're going to do it anyway. Well, it may be true that almost everybody does it at one time or another, but it's not true that they have to keep doing it. And sometimes it enslaves, just like alcohol or pornography or other things that we become habituated to. And we have to be very careful in talking about this, I think, because we may give too much license and we may encourage other problems Many people, because of masturbation, get into pornography for the first time, and then pornography becomes an issue in their lives, a very important issue, I might add, that can really destroy many things. So when we're talking about the issue of sex with young people, we need to encourage them that they do not have to be engaged in it, that it is something that's wonderful, it's a gift from God to them, but it's to be used only in the marriage relationship, and even then it's to be used in the right way and to be enjoyed in the right way, and that it doesn't make them more of a man or a woman to engage in it. Let me say a word real quickly, too, about parents. We know that parents are not to provoke their children, Ephesians 6, 1 through 3, and Colossians 3, 20. And when it comes to sex, the teenager and sex and their parents, some parents want to get their kids started on, their daughter start on birth control pills or buy condoms for their sons with the idea that they're going to do it anyway, so I'm going to protect them. Well, there are other ways to protect them. We can be sure that they are having frank discussions about sex, about birth control, that they understand all the issues, that they understand how people get pregnant and why, and that, yes, you can get pregnant the first time you have sex, all those issues. We can make it very clear to them how to prevent sex without encouraging them by buying them condoms or getting them started on the pill or whatever. I think as Christian parents, certainly we have to encourage our children that not only not to engage in premarital sex, but we need to let them know it is expected of them that they will abstain and that we will not help them in their sin. Sometimes that's really hard for parents. But we need to encourage them that way. Also, there is the young person you will counsel and work with in youth situation whose parents think it's just fine, and you are having to encourage the young person to go against the wishes of their parents, or at least go against the freedom that their parents give them. And in such a situation, you want to be very respectful to the parents and yet respectfully let the child know that this is one area in which God and their parents disagree, and so they must obey God. There's much more we could say about the child and the culture, but I hope that what we've said up to this point will give you some ideas to think upon and to further investigate as you go on with the other parts of this course. This has been 5